Hi, and welcome back to the seventh episode of the Pathfinders podcast. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to the previous episodes, and also like the new look for the podcast graphics too. We also worked very hard on the fifth episode on our YouTube channel with the interview with Chad Grenier, head of game design for Apex Legends. We really wanted to make this a visual experience for this medium, despite not having this interview recorded with video. If you haven't had a chance yet to check out the YouTube video, then there is a link in the description which will take you to our YouTube page. We did a special episode last time looking at our new print magazine, Volume 6 of 99% Lifestyle, where myself and Emily had a chat about all things Volume 6 and the print industry. Even though Episode 6 was a special episode, we are back to the regular format today. Episode 7 features an interview with photographer and entrepreneur Chase Jarvis. Chase is a world-renowned photographer who has worked with some of the biggest brands out there. Chase is also very business savvy, having created one of the first camera applications for the iTunes Store, and the first that allowed people to add filters to their photos and share them on social media. Chase is also the creator of Creative Live, a teaching platform with a freemium model that teaches people through live creative courses all around the world every single day. Aside from Chase's businesses, he also has a big personal brand. He regularly publishes content online, does talks all around the world, and has also published his own book called Creative Calling, which looks at how we can all be creative and become more healthy. I've been a big fan of Chase's work, and he's someone who was on my list of people I wanted to interview back when starting 99% Lifestyle almost 5 years ago. Chase has a very inspirational story, but something I really admire about him is how good of an interviewer he is. He's a very smart individual and knows how to conduct really great interviews. This is something I'm always looking to get better at as I continue to interview tons of creatives each and every year. Chase's 30 Days of Genius series on YouTube, where he sits down with some of the greatest creatives and entrepreneurs, is something you should all really go and check out. It also shows off Chase's ability to conduct brilliant interviews. Episode 7 will feature Chase's story, building a business, being creative, and looking at various other topics such as how to ask better questions as an interviewer, and the subjects covered in his new book around creativity. Before we get into today's interview, this is a piece of content taken from Volume 6 of 99% Lifestyle, which is out now. Volume 6 features over 20 different pieces of content, from feature-length interviews with designers, in-depth looks into the video game industry, and really interesting interviews and features that look at topics such as how marine scientists in Australia are using a type of seaweed to eliminate almost all the methane production that is caused in a cow's diet. If you head over to the 99% Lifestyle website, then you will see a link at the top of the page that shares everything about Volume 6. You'll also find a link to the latest magazine in the description of this episode. Copies of our magazine are £10, and these magazines are more like books. They're printed on thick paper, have soft-touched and forward cover elements, and a lot of time and effort goes into how this magazine looks. We really want this publication to be a beautiful object that sits on your bookshelf or coffee table. If you enjoy what we do and want to support the free content that we put out on this podcast and in our weekly newsletter, then head to our website and support us by visiting the 99% Lifestyle store. We have a range of products on there, from clothing-related products, prints, and print magazines. That can all be found simply on 99%lifestyle.com. Now, let's get into today's episode with photographer and entrepreneur Chase Jarvis. Just to get things started, could you tell me a bit about yourself and who you are? Because I know a lot of your story is already out there.
Sure. So I guess the place that I like to start that is I was very busy living the life that everybody else wanted for me for a long time. And it wasn't a bad life, it was a fine life, but it was, you know, with the expectations of going to this college and getting these grades and going on to be a doctor or a lawyer or something impressive by someone else's standards. And I was fine with that. I didn't really understand my own autonomy and authority and authenticity. And a couple things changed along the way. Right, a week before my college graduation, my grandfather dropped dead of a heart attack, and I had no, you know, no foresight, no insight into that, and it was completely out of nowhere. And of course, it was terrible. But the silver lining was that I was given his cameras as part of in the will, and he was an avid hobbyist photographer and studied the craft and had taken pictures of me as a kid playing sports as a skateboarder and a soccer player, a football player, a skier, and I was always enamored with photography, but I didn't really have some deep connection to it. And on his passing, I felt the need to just examine my life again anytime these big moments happen to us. And so I put his camera and a couple things in a backpack with my then girlfriend, now wife, Kate, and I just went and basically, you know, traveled the world, ate beans and tuna fish and slept on the ground, and discovered that we really only have one life. And if I was going to lead it, I had to find a way to pursue something I was actually passionate about. So fast forward, I bailed on a career in professional soccer. I dropped out of medical school and quit a PhD in philosophy to become a photographer. And it was in doing so, and recognizing that I have virtually every privilege you can have. I'm born white, male, in the United States at this particular time in history, and yet still like deciding very overtly in front of friends and family, and that to the tune of gigantic student loans, and I bailed on all that stuff to become a photographer. And it was a shock to so many, but it was the first step towards really understanding and like doing the things that I knew that I was meant to do on this earth, despite disappointing a lot of people that were very close to me. And it's sort of helped me come alive and start putting my sort of my my heart out there, my vision for this one life, because, you know, I have a belief that if you don't sort of write your own script, the world will write one for you. And in that moment, I started pulling on that thread, and it's life started happening for me rather than to me. And since that time, I went on to have a successful career as one of the top commercial photographers in the world, working for brands like, you know, Apple and Nike and Red Bull and, you know, dozens of other of the, you know, Fortune 100 companies. And then became interested in, you know, this life that I was living was producing such an amazing experience for me, and realizing how hard it was to make that transition. Just that, man, what if we could start making tools for other people to tap into their creativity? I realized unequivocally that every person in the world is creative, and I saw what sort of facing that and embracing it had done for me. So I started, I made the first iPhone app that shared photos to social networks back in 2009 as a little experiment. My photo studio, we had some extra money and some extra time, and lo and behold, it became the app of the year in the Apple Store. And so I saw what it was like to use technology to scale creativity for millions and millions of people, parlayed that into building a platform for creators that is now almost 10 years old. In 2010, we launched the world's first live streaming learning platform. And today it's the largest in the world for creators. It's called Creative Live. Where, you know, more than 20 million people go to learn photography, design, filmmaking. And, you know, here we are. I consider myself like very, very focused on creativity and living this one true life. I've started connecting the dots looking backwards, as you have. You know, you can look at my own story made sense. I discovered my career. I pursued it, found a way to make it a reality, built tools for creators, then built a platform for people to learn, but I still didn't have the why. Like, why does all this matter? And despite having, you know, spent a lot of time thinking about that, that's what prompted the book. So in September, I dropped the book Creative Calling. Harper was my publisher, and it went straight to the bestseller lists here in the US, and still now like focused on helping as many people as I can tap into that true calling that they have, whether that's, you know, regardless of where it takes you, that idea of pursuing the thing that you're put on this planet to do is just a powerful one. So my own arc, and I also don't want to paint the picture that any of it was easy or linear. Like, these are not those are not words that I would use to describe my sort of life arc, but just how fulfilling and how the opportunity is there if you are willing to sort of look for it. So, I think my personal life arc maps to a lot of the life arcs of other folks. And when we start to realize that we're all in this together and that creativity is this unequivocally present thing in every person, and it becomes, how do we pursue that and unlock it? That's sort of what I'm all about. So there you go. That's 40 years in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, first off, congratulations on the book hitting the New York Times bestseller. And yeah, you've had a very successful career. I'm going to take a few steps back. And something that Lewis Howes spoke to me about when I interviewed him was how he attributed sports and doing sports at an early age to kind of giving him this kind of skill set and really helped him out in the business world. Do you attribute any of your success down to those skills you learned during soccer or football, as we call it here in the UK?
I definitely wouldn't be the person that I am without that background, especially playing soccer at a reasonably high level. Again, I went to college on a soccer scholarship. I played for the U.S. Olympic development team as a 19-year-old. And there's so many parallels between competition, whether it's in sport or elsewhere, and being able to pursue the things that you want to pursue in life. Like most people have the belief that life happens to you. You know, you're a cork bobbing in the tide. And that's part of what I understood about creativity. There's creativity with a small c in all the ways we think about it, like photography and design and, you know, filmmaking, or all, you know, anything that you, coding, all those things are obviously wildly creative. But the interesting thing when you start to embrace that side of yourself, and this is a big theme in the book, it's all creativity, right? But what you realize when you do those things in small daily ways that you actually have autonomy and the ability to create the life that you want. So to me, it was when I, with sports comes the discipline and the concept of seasons and pushing really hard and then resting and recovering and exploring, going to places where you didn't know you could go physically, emotionally, and mentally. There's all those, you know, parallels for sport, and unequivocally it was incredibly valuable. But I would say without the vision that in creating in small daily ways, what we're actually doing is giving ourselves a roadmap to create the living and the life that we want for ourselves. To me, that was the big unlock. Because sports and passion and you know, all of the hard work without direction or without understanding that you actually have, you know, the ability to create the life that you want with this one precious small time that we have, I think, you know, those things combine to be a powerful vehicle.
Something I hear you getting asked quite a bit is people asking you how you became a big photographer, and I hear you answer it quite often about, you know, you need to become good at your craft and put in the 10,000 hours. And I heard you mention on the Tim Ferriss podcast about that once you got great at your craft, that a lot of doors did open for you once you was able to build up your social following. Can you talk about how you was able to build up that following after you got great at your craft?
Yeah, I think so many people, and it's understandable why, right? We're looking for shortcuts. And we want to have the fastest, the best result with the least time invested. And, you know, part of it's going to be a little bigger bite than your question asks. But, like, I feel like go way back in my own my own story. Tell me the thing that I said both on Lewis's and on, or yeah, on Lewis's and on Tim's. Were they connected? I forgot.
The thing you mentioned on Tim's was about putting in the 10,000 hours work and really getting great at your craft.
I think we all want shortcuts, and it's understandable why, but the reality is if you can't actually do the thing, you start to realize that you can fool somebody once or fool somebody twice, but actually being good at the thing that you want to be doing in the world, two things. One, it only comes from repetition. And two, if you haven't actually put in the work, the people who are ahead of you in line or for whom, you know, your future might be helped if they recognize you or take you under their wing, they all know whether or not you've done the work. And so to me, this idea of pursuing, that's why you need to find something that you care deeply about. Because when you pursue that and it gets hard, and it will, everything gets hard, if especially if you want to do it at a high level, if you don't actually aren't working on something that you care deeply about, then pursuing that craft and getting up after you've fallen down for the 200th time is not going to be easy or natural or something that you're really motivated to do. And you know, when I see entrepreneurs chase market opportunities, or I see people pursue the path that their parents or their career counselor or whatever wants them to do, when things get hard, they invariably stop. And, you know, given how important craft is, and given that if mastery is 10,000 hours, like you have to put in at least that much before you're even in the realm of, you know, being considered a high performer. And the ability to do that without being passionate is something I have not seen in people. Like there's a reality of if you just need all of the juice you can have in order to go as far as you want in your life. And without that deep, deep passion and connection to the thing you're trying to work on, I don't see people finding success, or rather being able to create their own success in a world where they're working on someone else's passion.
And something that your book looks at, like you said, is that about how everyone is creative. And I've heard you mention before that by this year, that 50%, I think, of the US working population would be making money on the side from some sort of a source. Do you think it's easier nowadays for people to get a self-sustaining income on a creative passion, or do you think it's harder to reach that point?
Yeah, well, we've been sold a lie, and that lie is sold to us by suckers who are charlatans on TV or online. And there's this myth of the entrepreneur, the creator, going all in, and you push all your chips and you take the second mortgage on your house. And if you ask anyone who's actually, you know, created the success or the life that they want to live, that's actually not how you do it. You do it by in small daily habits. You know, that's to me, you know, if you look at there's three really big boulders that the book talks about. One, that everyone's creative by nature with limitless possibility. And if you can understand that, then the next sort of piece is that creativity is a habit. It's not a skill. It's a way of operating in the world. It's like a muscle, like any muscle we develop, right? It's strengthened through use. And so if you believe that everyone's creative, and you believe that, you know, that creativity is a muscle, that it's only then by working out that muscle vis-a-vis creating every day, that it's only through creating anything that we understand that we can create everything. And to me, that is a simple but profound, I would say a simple but profound unlock. And I think it's wildly misunderstood. As you write, I talk a lot about it in the book. It's really only through creating in small daily ways that we get to create the life that we want for ourselves.
And I wanted to go back a little bit more about you as an entrepreneur and entrepreneurship, because you've clearly had it from a kid where you was, you know, collecting golf balls and selling them back to golfers on the next hole, or making, you know, a short film as a profit.
You've been your research.
Have you always had that spark then, and do you attribute that to family members or anything like that, or was it just something that you just seemed to do as a small kid, really off your own back?
Let me, so two things. One, I don't know where that came from. My parents were both, my dad was a cop and my mom was a secretary. I was raised in a middle or lower middle class family. You know, I always had a roof over my head. I wasn't an unsafe place at all, but we weren't at all wealthy. And I think there was a little bit of it that certainly comes from my childhood, which I'm also an only child, so I didn't have brothers and sisters. And the combination of not having a lot of money and not having any brothers or sisters made me have a, you know, spend a lot of time in my imagination. And in your imagination, that's one of the things we've sort of, the desire and the ability to dream is something that we've snuffed out in so many of our young people. And I was able to keep that alive, you know, to keep this, my imagination, my belief of what was possible, mostly because I didn't have a lot of people, you know, in my face telling me no. My parents were always very supportive, but I certainly think that that had an early impact on my desire to, you know, I go back to my first film. I'm in my first film, I think either 7 or 8. It was called The Sons of Zorro. We washed cars in the neighborhood to earn enough money to buy the film. We borrowed a Super 8 camera from my friend's dad. My friend's brother was the cinematographer, and we acted out a little script that we had wrote, and then we screened the film in our neighborhood, and we made a profit. We made more money than we spent. And, you know, I don't know how many films in Hollywood can say we made a profit, but it was really a powerful experience. And that, you know, again, it was very, very early. And I remember thinking, I wonder if I could just do this. You know, I see my parents go to work and maybe there's a world where I can just, I mean, I clearly made money, and this is like at a 7-year-old. So I don't know actually where it came from. My family isn't a family of entrepreneurs or artists, but I think there was a certain grit that I was raised with, because I certainly didn't have it easy. But it's really hard to say that and to claim that, again, knowing that the privilege, the relative privilege that I come from being a white male. So there's a really interesting piece that if it was hard for me both to find a way to express myself, to suppress that, all the things that everybody else wanted for me. It's not lost how hard that is for the rest of us. And so I'm trying to change the script, change the narrative, that not only by tapping into your passions as a young child, like I did, making films and earning money and selling golf balls. Those are things that were curious to me. It's like that childlike wonder that we have. If we can continue to maintain that vision as an adult, or now, that's part of what I'm trying to do with the book, is help people recognize that not only is it not too late now, but it's never too late to tap into that. I just happened to find that as an 8, 10, 12-year-old entrepreneur. And you know, that's, that childlike wonder is the gift that I'm hoping to give people, and trying to, you know, be an example. Like I was to be clear, I also made a ton of mistakes. Like I don't want to paint a picture where it's, you know, I just automatically knew what I wanted to do and found it. And no, I pursued the path of, that everybody else wanted me. I got $100,000 in debt in student loans, in graduate school, in pursuit of being a doctor and things that would be esteemed by my parents and my parents' friends. And that just, it left me so, so disappointed and basically broken and very, you know, very poor financially. But to me, this, the ability to, at some point, even at that, you know, place of despair, if you do turn to your path and you listen to the things that you're supposed to be doing, because all that information is in you. We're just programmed culturally and from our parents and our career counselors not to pursue it. I think I just learned that at a bunch of really critical points in my path, and certainly my grandfather's passing. And then later in life, after I had decided to pursue a career as a photographer and found great success there, I sort of got complacent, and then I was almost killed in an avalanche. And that was a wake up call for me to wait, you know, you've basically unlocked one piece of your life, but you got more work to do, because you want to give this gift that you've created, this understanding that we are limitless potential. You want to try and help other people see that. So there are various markers along my path, and this is pretty laid out pretty clearly in the book, that have contributed to that. I don't know, you know, again, if we're a product of both nature and nurture, I can't attribute it to any one thing, but I do know that the hardest thing that it was for me to overcome was the willingness to disappoint people who care and who are giving you all this feedback. And I think that's the hardest part of anyone's journey, is that you're getting advice from people on where to go on a journey that they've never been, right? Your career counselor, your parents. And so these are people, this advice of going and doing the safe thing, is it comes from people you respect and you care about, and it matches with the social paradigm of what we should do. And that's part of what makes it so hard. You get valuable information that meets the social universe's criteria from people that you really love. And in the end, it's terrible advice. It's the advice, this concept of, you know, there's actually never been a more risky time to play it safe, because that safety that your parents and your career counselor and your teachers and your friends, that it's a prescription that's not going to lead to happiness or to fulfillment, right? That's a thing that's going to check a box for somebody else. So to me, that, I don't know where it came from, but I think those things are the biggest forces working against us culturally. And the ability to look at them and name them and understand them, to me, is part of the process of being able to subvert them.
Yeah. And have you had anything that hasn't worked out to the point where you had to evaluate whether or not, should I carry on pursuing this, or should I go back to the drawing board and start something else? Because I suppose that could be quite valuable for people who are trying to, you know, really turn a passion into a career, but it's not going anywhere. Can you resonate with that at all?
Oh, of course. And I think there's, I'll try and get this right. When that comes into play, I turn to a friend of mine's advice. His name is Chris Guillebeau. And, you know, it's a two-part test. One, do I still love this thing? And two, is it working? And, you know, you can see a world where, yes, I love this and it's working. Great, keep doing it. Yes, I love this, and no, it's not working. And so when there's that conflict, then you have to say, oh my gosh, is it not working? You know, why is it not working? Am I willing? Do I love it enough to keep after it? But you can also see a world where I don't love this and it's not working, right? So that's really obvious what you should do then. You should change directions. And, you know, I think we are, again, sold. We're given, culturally, we're given white ribbons for participating in everything. And that's fine. I'm not about being, you know, it's not necessarily about tough love. But at the end of the day, it is these small sort of failures that remind you that, I say, remember why you started on any journey. Go back to that feeling. And I like to have two points of view on it. One, quitting can be a fantastic and powerful thing, especially for me, like quitting the pursuit of being a doctor, or dropping out of the soccer program that I was on to come play in Europe. Like, we're sold a belief that quitting is horrible. And those two, you know, quitting those two things are two of the things that unlocked the possibility in my life. So to me, this understanding of when you should quit and when you should push through is a really, it's a great and focused question. To me, I use that evaluation, that little matrix that I gave you from Chris, but also that's why this ability to listen to what's actually in here and turn off all the noise that's out here is such a critical skill. And it's a skill we're not taught, right? It's a skill where we're programmed. I remember my second grade teacher, I overheard my teacher telling my parents that Chase is so much better at sports than he is at art. And as a little, you know, what are you in second grade? You're 8 or something like that. You're like, I remember not being crushed at all, but just like, oh, okay, then I'm going to do more sports, because we're social animals. All we want to do is fit in at a biological fundamental level. And I just think of how harmful that can be unknowingly, that's not my second grade teacher, like she wasn't intending that because she was, it was right. I mean, I ended up going to soccer or college on a soccer scholarship. But just this ability to keep the noise out and to stay true to who we are and what's in here, I think that is a skill that we haven't taught our kids. And that's something that, for better or worse, these big moments in our lives, the passing of my grandfather, me nearly dying in that accident, they have this profound, strikingly profound way of focusing our attention on what truly matters in here and developing our ability. You know, that's why the book is called Creative Calling, because we all have this inside us. And we've heard it. There are moments, if we look back in our life, where everything was easy and where things felt in the line. And all you have to do is look at that, even if it was for a day or a week or a season of your life or a chapter, like those, there's clues buried in there. You know, that's, and again, that's in here. That's not going to your parents or to your friend or to, you know, your Instagram feed to tell you what you should be doing with whom and where. So this internal compass, I think, is really critical. And one other piece about the compass, if I can, I think what we're sold culturally is a map. If you go to this school and get these grades, then you'll be on this trajectory for this career, and then you'll make this much money. And we're sold a map, right? And if you look at a map has a little dot. You are here, and then there's dashes, and the red X is over here. And you can see the whole journey, and you get this list of a prescription from all these people in your life. And the reality is that I don't know a single person who, when they started on that journey, that the journey they took ended up looking anything like the map they were sold. So to me, we need to ignore these cultural maps. And what we need to do is develop our compass. And if you think of the difference between a map and a map shows everything and a compass just shows a direction. And we have that direction, you know, built into our DNA. Our intuition is one of our most critical assets. And if we can learn to not have to see the whole journey, but just know that if we keep walking in this direction where we feel compelled, the direction that the compass is pointing, that sure, you might have to go around some things, a lake or over a hill, but it's this compass that we all have, and we need to get comfortable not knowing the whole journey. I can't see over the horizon. I can see to the edge of the horizon. You don't need to see the whole staircase. You need to see the next step. So to me, it's just, there's some sort of a combination. If we can pay attention to that internal compass, that learn to turn off this all this other noise, that's where the best things in life are.
And something you mentioned during the answer as well was how you still remember a story back from your childhood in education. And I know you're not the biggest fan of the modern education system. Would you say that's part of the reason that led you to start Creative Live, which educates people all over the world?
For sure. And to be fair, like, my wife was a public school teacher for a long time, and the school system didn't do me wrong, but it certainly didn't do me right. And I saw it miss on so many other people where, you know, we don't have the, you know, the breadth of understanding. We have a very linear system, and it's not the system's fault. The system, like, it wants us to be safe. It wants us to be able to predict our outcomes. And that's why it's modeled after the factory, right? The school system puts us in at one end, and we all go into one end, and then it marches us through this conveyor belt, all getting the same nuts and bolts attached to us and at the same time in our development. And we all know that's not how humans work. And we all know that life isn't linear. And yes, the modern school system tries to do that. It's ultimately sort of a babysitting system that is designed around being able to achieve average results. And I think if you deconstruct that, and you're like, I don't want to live an average life. I don't want to have average results. And you can't have a system that's designed to create average results to create outstanding outcomes. So I don't actually throw rocks I don't have to love the school system. I think it does an okay job of what it's designed to do, which is, you know, sadly, it's designed to create us for careers that no longer exist in a way of thinking that's largely outdated. And so indeed, we have to supplement our learning with things beyond the walls of school. And, you know, now more than ever before, you know, I believe that you can't it's hard to, it's, you can't be what you can't see. And now that information's moving more quickly, we have so many more examples of what's possible with a life. And so while school has some foundational baseline value, it's designed for average outcome. And if you want something above average outcome, and you can now, because of information, you know, see what's possible with a life, because, you know, there's so many extraordinary people and that you can discover and connect with online in actual meaningful ways. But to me, what was, you know, in part what was missing was all of these other lessons that I'm sharing with you that aren't taught in schools. And so indeed, you know, Creative Live came about, you know, with the goal of transcending a couple barriers that school typically has. One is, you know, geography. It's hard to learn from the best if you're in Birmingham, as you are, and the best might be in New York or LA or Seoul, Korea, or somewhere else. And yet the internet can usurp that problem and deliver the world's best right into your office there. And also financially, like, you know, I went $100,000 in debt. And to me, that is just catastrophic and a sign of a broken, sick system. Certainly in the United States, credit card debt is outpaced only by student debt, $1.3 or $1.4 trillion. And so, you know, it's not a stretch to see how toxic and unhelpful that is. So, you know, at Creative Live, I wanted to create a platform that would be either free or cheap. And then lastly, the access, not just geographical, like where you are in the world, but access to the world's top experts and a focus on creativity and entrepreneurship. Those are things that didn't exist really in the schools and the worlds that I grew up in. And so certainly, if, you know, providing an opportunity like Creative Live, that was definitely part of the original vision. And, you know, to see it have come to life, as you know, brings me immense amounts of joy. And, you know, we're 10 years in now, you know, tens of millions of people served, billions of minutes of video. And I still can't help but feel like we're just getting started. I was in a big team meeting yesterday, just level of inspiration and motivation and where we want to do and what we want to accomplish. And again, we're just a drop in the bucket, even though we're helping tens of millions of people. But I think if you can't be what you can't see. So we're trying to put examples of an amazing life that we can design. That's a really important concept, that these lives are designed. They don't just happen. They have to be, you know, there's the people that you aspire to or that motivate or inspire you, the lives that they're leaving, those were designed. They didn't just happen. And you start to be able to deconstruct the lives of the people you admired, the path that they took, in part through regular school, but mostly through the school of life, like, then you start to be able to put together what's possible with this one precious life that we all have.
And as you mentioned that you wanted it to always be free, that's something that I I really like about the fact that it is accessible to anyone. Anyone can consume that content for free if they tune in live. Was that a model that you saw used somewhere else, or was that a model you just created from scratch for Creative Life?
Yeah, myself and my co-founder created, it was the first model that I'd ever seen where anyone in the world could watch the content that we were creating for free, and that you only had to pay if you wanted to own the content and watch it over and over and over. It's a very open model. In a sense, it's like a sort of a freemium model, I guess. That's what sort of internet lingo is for it. But that idea hadn't ever been done before in the realm of content, right? In the realm of we're going to give this away while we're making it. And, you know, today there are more than 2,000 classes. We've got 12,000 hours of learning. And despite having all of that, that catalog and the inertia, and to this day and forever, you will be able to go to Creative Live and watch the stuff that we're sharing. Some subset of our catalog will be free forever. And like we have data that the more that you consume of this content, the more likely you are to buy. So we get to both help the world, and every time at Creative Live, you're helping offset that cost for the 99% of people, or the 90% of people rather, who can't afford it or are just starting on their journey. So there's this pay it forward mentality that we've created at Creative Live, which means the world to me. And to know that there's millions of people and consuming billions of minutes of video is energizing. But again, I'm nowhere close to done.
And one of my favorite pieces of content, or I suppose series of content, that has been put out by yourself is the 30 Days of Genius series from Creative Live. If you had to look back at all of those interviews you did, what would you say are some of the most impactful things you learned from talking to those people that actually affected you personally or in the business point, which you learned and applied to your own life?
That's a great question, Connor. Couple of bullets, but I think one of the most sharply articulated of them is you have to be willing to be misunderstood for long periods of time in order to truly tap into the thing that you want to be. None of that happens overnight. And it's that, you know, keeping the noise, the chatter of all the people. And these are people that may mean a lot to you in life, but the ability to be misunderstood and to have this conviction, this authority and authenticity within you to truly go after the things that you want. That was a recurring theme in, you know, in all of the 30 conversations with those geniuses. And it maps to my own experience as well, that this willingness to, you know, for Jared Leto to, you know, be a you know, platinum selling musician and win an Oscar. Like you're not told that you can do those two things, you know, that they're not reconcilable. And, you know, Mark Cuban sold his company at like 38 years old or 40 years old or 37 for $5 billion. Like, you know, that's not something that, that people tell you is possible in your life. And yet, you know, Mark had a vision for his life. Brené Brown, like, you know, being vulnerable and sharing her research on shame and vulnerability was the most powerful thing that she could do. It is literally her being vulnerable was the thing that catapulted her career to, you know, where she is today, affecting tens of millions of people around the world and helping them, you know, find human connection. And that connection empowers them to live the life of their dreams. So there's this a willingness that when it's dark for you and the other people around you can't see what it is you're doing, the vision and willingness to stay the course, if it's true for you, is just incredibly powerful medicine. That was very, very consistent. Another consistent, I think, takeaway from those conversations is that there's patience. You know, none of this happens overnight, and we're talking about shaping the arc of your life. It's like lots of small successes in the micro. You're, you know, constantly working, but again, achieving the things that you want to, that often takes much longer than the lie that we're told on Instagram or that we're sold in our business schools and the places where we go to learn. And so to me, that, you know, a little bit related to the being willing to be misunderstood, but for long periods of time, like there's this patience aspect to it. And then I think the final one is everyone who is a top performer has some sort of this connection between a mentality, basically a growth mindset. Like the mindset was remarkably consistent. And again, these are things that I'm saying I learned in 30 Days of Genius, but they more validated what I had experienced as true for me. And, you know, go back to the school system that you were right to remind me and others that that's not something I'm a huge fan of. But just another example there is that you know, where are we taught that how important that, you know, mindset matters most? It's the thing that, you know, that's the thing, the strength of your mindset, the willingness to learn, to fail and stumble, to be vulnerable. Like all of those things are really key attributes on our journey. And yet we're really not given the tools in a typical education in order to pursue them. So, you know, I think those are a couple of the key things that I took away from the 30 Days of Genius series that again, none of this is new. It's surprisingly consistent, but it's not the thing that bubbles up in pop culture discussions because it's hard. It takes a long time. And these are not things that are that are commonly shared with us as young people in society.
And on the back, it's quite similar to the 30 Days of Genius question, but I suppose this question could be pursued quite selfish as such, because me personally, I'm trying to get better at interviewing myself, and I'm a big fan of your interview style, and there was clearly a lot that you put into it, because I can't remember where I read this or saw this, but I remember seeing you saying ages ago about how just by nodding you can get drawing more information out of the person, and I saw all those interviews as very, very conversational. So I wanted to look at a bit more about what went into your interview prep work and how you was able to ask such great questions, I guess, in your interviews.
The answer might be a little bit disappointing, because there's a certain part of it is being willing to not be trapped in my head thinking of the next question, or having, to me, my preparation is basically my willingness to let the conversation go wherever and trusting that in the moment I will be able to connect with this person if I'm present. So it's almost antithetical to most people's preparation for an interview. I almost try and clear my mind and ask very, very, of course, open-ended, but also very heartfelt, earnest questions without sort of trying to steer the conversation in a direction. And that is it has a lot to do with learning to listen and actually be present in a weird roundabout way. My wife is a mindfulness and meditation teacher, and I'm deeply inspired by her ability to be present with people in any moment. Like the person who's serving her coffee at the coffee shop, like she can just be so present. And for me, when you're in the presence of someone who is present, I feel that sense of human connection that I think we're all craving for, especially in this time and age where we're theoretically more connected, but we're also more isolated. So this fundamental idea of connection, and again, it's a trust, it's a willingness to not feel like you have to control the conversation. To me, that is a signal to people that there's a trust and a vulnerability that I'm trying to offer, that in turn, I think, you know, we're biological species too, right? We're social animals. This nod, the triple nod, is also, you know, mirror neurons are at work there. When I signal wide eyes and anticipation and openness, like that person then feels those things. So it's a handful of very, very soft skills that, you know, I've been able to develop over the course of hundreds and hundreds of interviews with the world's, you know, with billionaire icon and entrepreneurs and Pulitzer Prize winners, Grammy winners, you know, some of the brightest and best minds of our time. And you can't help, like, it's not an accident that I created a lifelong learning platform. I mean, I'm passionate about lifelong learning. And if you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with, I'm certainly aspiring to spend my time with, you know, the most amazing people that I can find on the planet. So developing a system of asking them questions and learning from them is obviously, it's certainly, there's a selfish, as you pointed out with your question, there's a selfish motivation there. But if I can unlock one secret, whether it's mindset or patience or grit, if I can unlock one of those like insights from someone I'm talking to, while it may benefit me, that's one of the reasons I share all these conversations. I was having them in private for years before I even had the podcast, and the podcast is 10 years old now. So like, I don't know. It's to me, this is a virtuous cycle. The more that I can learn and subsequently share will in turn help more people. So learned skill, but there's a lot of a trust, and it comes through experience. But the cool thing is that's available to anyone. Vulnerability is available to you right now. Authenticity, who you really are, showing up as that person rather than the facade of a person you aspire to be more like the ability to show up is always there for you. And I think that's what I find for people who have are comfortable in their own skin is they basically have become comfortable being uncomfortable. And that's a very, very powerful, it's a powerful attribute, and it's a great lesson to learn.
Yeah. And going into those conversations, do you find yourself looking a lot into what the person's already said and things like that? Because I know you're a fan of someone who I've also interviewed, Debbie Millman, and I know she has this like 40 pages worth of research on people going into the interview, and they seem to know everything about the person. Is that something that you've picked up from her as well, or do you tend not to do that?
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, I've also been interviewed by Debbie, and she found insane things about me on the internet that I like only my mom knows, so I don't know how Debbie knows them. And I do pride myself on, to me, it's less about prepping for the interview as a moment in time, and it's more curiosity about someone's experiences that they've shared either in a book or another podcast, or where I'm inspired by the life that I can see them leading even from a distance. So I do most of my research before deciding to invite someone on the show. But so it's a little less about sort of focus and prepping for the conversation, and a little bit more like surveying the horizon for people who are inspiring and for whom, you know, I have a particular curiosity about them or what they've done with their life or an area of interest where I know I'm trying to, you know, trying to learn a lot. And I think there's so much at play with pursuing our own curiosity. You know, right now there's someone who's, who's on the other side of the planet and doesn't have the experience of trusting their own curiosity, because that has been trained out of us to be curious and to wonder a little bit. And, you know, we have to be focused, we have to go to school, we have to do this and become this. And to me, like, unwinding that social narrative is a really powerful tool for being able to tap into that, you know, that one precious life that we're supposed to be leading. So I appreciate that style. I do most of my work at a more macro level earlier on in the process, and then I've come to trust that the conversation will be authentic.
Okay, yeah, that's really interesting. And I've only got a few more questions I wanted to ask you, and I just wanted to ask you a question about the book again, Creative Calling, and just look at what, from your perspective, what can people expect from the book, and what are Who is the book for, and what should they expect to get from it, I guess?
Sure. Well, the book is written for two populations of people. One, people who identify as a creator. They understand that it's in their creativity that vast power lives, and your ability to create, not just in small daily ways, but in the big way, like capital C, creating your life. And so for those people, this book is a validation. It will help you organize and understand the things that you've believed about yourself or about culture, but is not being said elsewhere. So it's sort of like a rally cry, like, I see you, I hear you, and what you're doing is not crazy, and your ideas are yours and worthy of pursuing. And then the second group is a group of what I call creative curious. And these are people who understand that there's something here, but I'm not quite sure what it is, and I've been taught not to trust in it and believe in it, and so for those folks, this book will help them understand that thing that they haven't been able to understand, and show them that not only is it a tool, but our creativity is the most powerful tool that we have as humans. And and to me, those two groups of people for whom I wrote the book, you know, those are the people that now that the book's been out for 3 months, is, you know, I can open my phone at any time and just see the book resonating with people through, you know, my DMs and screenshots and just the messages that come in. And despite the fact that I get that feedback, it's still, you know, I am just getting started with putting this message out in the world, despite having worked on it for 10 years myself. And, you know, the book has been, it's been in process for probably 5 of those years. And then it took me 2 years to write it, and it's only been out for 3 months. And I feel like those messages I'm still trying to carry out there into the world, and they're going to be they're not going away anytime soon. I feel like I'm just getting started on that. So to me, those are the groups that I wrote it for. And then what can you expect? I think you can expect a reinforcement that every single person is creative, that creativity is a habit. It's a way of operating. It's not a skill. It's available to everyone. And it's up to you to, just like any other muscle, like this is, if you stay in shape in your creative world, that you truly do have unlimited potential, and that by creating in small daily ways that you can create anything. It's just creativity at a different scale. So, you know, and part of the books that I had always read about creativity, there's some amazing books out there, you know, Big Magic from Liz Gilbert, The Artist's Way, Julia Cameron. These are just like classics. But what they both miss for me is this, like basically a system, the ability to create organized thought around these things versus just, you know, whimsy and I'm a very systematic thinker. I need it to make sense logically. See my, you know, my background and my PhD in philosophy, like it needs to make sense. And so that's, I organized the book around just four parts. And it's an acronym, and the acronym is IDEA, I-D-E-A. I stands for imagine. I said earlier, we've sort of lost our ability as people, or it's trained out of us to imagine what's possible with this one precious life. So the second one is D. Once you've imagined what you want for yourself, and this is true for any individual project at work or for your life, you're designing a path to get there, right? You're designing a system of, if I do these things, if I lift weights every day, I will get stronger. If I draw every day, I will become a better drawer. You're designing a series of habits that will help you get to that goal. And then the E is executing. You know, you've imagined what's possible. You've designed a plan. Now you're just executing against that plan. And then the last section of the book, and again, this framework for creativity is A, it's amplify. And what I mean by amplify is, to me, this is one of the most misunderstood things about creating anything, whether it's a product or, you know, or your life, that amplifying that what it is that we're trying to do, sharing this vision with other people, building community around our ideas, getting other people involved to both help and assist and guide and motivate. That community aspect is, to me, something that's that's wildly misunderstood. We have, you know, creators that are worried about their ideas getting stolen. We have a culture now where information moves so quickly, but we're more isolated than ever. So this aspect of community, and I mean actively creating community around our beliefs and our ideas, is just a very powerful part in the creative process. And so, you know, basically the one of the things that the people can, who read the book, can understand and take away is basically a very simple but profound framework for any creative process. Again, any individual product or project or something as big as creating a framework for the life that you want. Mm. So it's very, there's this ability to have these big ideas, but then, you know, very tactically attack.
Yeah. And I'm guessing it's better for people to get the book via the Creative Calling website, because there's some bonuses and that people can get on there.
Of course, Amazon is a great place to steer people, just because it's easy and there's, you know, audio versions and whatnot. But if, yeah, people, there are some bonuses, access to a free Creative Live class. There's a handful of bonuses at the creativecalling.com website. So those are both great places, but it's available everywhere books are sold. And obviously Amazon ends up being best for a lot of people. And I encourage the hard copy just because, it's, you know, this, it's very specially designed. It's, this is, it's basically just a blank canvas when you remove the half a jacket. And that is a, in many ways, a signal of this, what we're given with life. We have, you know, we have the ability to write our own story, and there's been this amazing, like, it's a blank canvas on purpose. And I thought I would have to share with people, like, this is meant to be, this is your own canvas. But now, you know, there's thousands of people all over the world that are drawing, and you can see these pictures, you know, I sometimes reshare them on my Insta or on Amazon, that people are literally taking it, or are taking it literally, and they're like making beautiful art, not required at all, but I think as a metaphor for life, I think it's a pretty fun and playful thing. So I encourage people to get the hardback if they can, just for the experience of touching and feeling a thing. But I did do my own stunts. I read my own audio. So if you want to hear my voice for, oh God, 8 hours, reading my own book, that's a, you know, great. Pick up the audio book.
Okay. So I just wanted to, one of the last questions for the interview is, what advice would you like to leave someone like myself who's starting to, who's trying to grow a print magazine business?
I would take the content out. So whether you're trying to grow a print magazine business or trying to become an architect or start your own company, my advice is the same. And that is you have to pursue the thing and pull on the thread and be invested and focused on what it is that you see for yourself in spite of the inputs from everyone else. To me, that's the hardest thing. You're going to have people asking you, why would you possibly be wanting to create a print magazine in a world where everyone's digital and it's hard and expensive? And to me, like, as long as you've considered those things and you see a vehicle for what it is that you want to put out in the world and you're doing it, like, there's a proverb that is, it's evolved over time. It's often attributed to Chinese culture. But it goes like this: the person who believes something is not possible should not interrupt the person who's doing it. And you know, go back to the 30 Days of Genius conversation, and what I learned to be true for myself was just being willing to be misunderstood for long periods of time is critical to the success, and it's the only way we can truly stand out. You know, we have this desire to both stand out and fit in, and the reality is you can't do both at the same time. So knowing we're social creatures, it's against our biology to stand out. You know, it's a risky thing. We want to be accepted by the tribe. And so, you know, in order to be able to fulfill that and to be able to pursue who we truly are, we have to condition ourselves to be misunderstood, to be willing to be who we are vulnerably and authentically. And with that, not only comes great opportunity, but comes great personal power. So, you know, to me, again, the content, whether you're trying to build a magazine or, you know, build an app or start a coffee shop, it's all the same advice.
I hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode with Chase Jarvis. This podcast is now available on YouTube and all major podcast platforms. If you would like to follow us on social media, then all the links can be found on the 99% Lifestyle website. You will also be able to find all the links in the description of this episode. At the end of each interview I conduct, I ask interviewees to give me 5 recommendations for our audience. This can be from books you should read, musicians you haven't heard of before, other podcasts to listen to, and documentaries you must watch. These recommendations are sent out as a free newsletter each and every week to the 99% Lifestyle newsletter subscribers. All issues are archived on our website too. If you would like to read Chase's recommendations, then head over to 99%lifestyle.com and you'll be able to find his recommendations as a recent issue in our archive. If you sign up to our newsletter, then that's also the best way to keep updated about all things 99% Lifestyle and to get notified about new podcast episodes. Thank you again for listening to today's episode. We'll be back very soon.